Somehow shape the future. I would hope and pray I'd touch lives by the way I live today.
Hey everyone, this is Steve Donahue with another episode of Legacy Podcast, equipping you to leave a legacy. And this episode is going to be a recording of a recent message that I gave to the church in which I pastor, Mount Tabor Baptist Church, from Esther chapter 5, and a continuation of that series where we are looking at the narrative of Esther from an expositional perspective. And it should be a good message for you. But before we listen to that, I want to take care of a little business and announce a few resources. First of all, if you're not a registered user, go ahead and become a registered user. That way you'll be able to know when there is a change to the website. Anything that I post, you'll be notified of that, and save you a little bit of time that way. Also, if you're not yet registered through iTunes or subscribed through iTunes or Stitcher or any of the downloading podcast host that you typically use, go ahead and do that. Of course, if you subscribe through various means like that, then it helps us to be able to be more noticed in those categories, and so I encourage you to do that. And then if you like the show well enough to support the show, the best way to do that is becoming a legacy partner. There's information about that in the show notes, and you can click on that and find out more. And if you're not yet if you've not yet been over to the homeschoolhope.com podcast and taken a look at that and listened to a couple of those, if you are a homeschooler, you will certainly find those to be encouraged. And if you're not a homeschooler, you may also want to go over there and just take a listen to find out who and what is going on in the homeschooling world. And I appreciate you checking that out as well. And then also, another way that you can support the show is by visiting our sponsors, or not our sponsors, I'm sorry, our affiliate links. And we have several affiliate relationships: U.S. Legal Forms, 48 Days, Amazon, Liberty Classroom, and Covenant Eyes. And if you are going to be frequenting any of those places, go ahead and take the link through my website. That way you can give me a little bit of commission, and it helps me be able to continue to produce this podcast and spend the money on hosting and the time that I do on it. So appreciate that. Enough of that. And so go ahead now and listen to this recording of Esther chapter 5.
What does it matter? That is actually a song title by Sheryl Crow. I'm not much into that kind of music, but I found this title and the words to this song on the internet this week, and it says this in part of the chorus. It says, "What does it matter anyway? What side of the road we're standing on? And just what does it matter anyway? If in the long run nothing changes after we are gone. If nothing changes after we are gone. Does it really matter? Does our life really matter? Do the actions that we take, do our attitudes towards life and to the situations that we have, do they really matter?" Well, of course, there are people in this world like this who would say that they don't really matter. Their life is just meaningless, that there isn't really any value to our life. But that's not the Christian idea. And that's not what the scriptures share. And what we're going to do today by looking at Esther chapter 5 is we are going to hopefully be convinced of the truth that our actions and our attitudes do matter. And we're going to look at that by contrasting two different characters in this passage. But before we do that, I think it's important for us to kind of refresh our minds as to where we've gotten to so far in the book of Esther, since we took a little bit of a break. And if you recall, Vashti, Ahasuerus' queen, was dethroned, and there was a great pageant of beauty to determine who was going to be the next queen, and it just so happened that Esther was chosen to become queen after Vashti. And Haman the Agagite, who was an enemy of the Jews, if you recall the long-lasting hatred between the Jews and the Agagites going all the way back to the time of the wilderness wandering and the marching into the promised land. And Haman is elevated to basically second in command of all of Ahasuerus' kingdom. And Haman has convinced the king to sign a law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be altered, to exterminate all the Jews. And the king becomes convinced that it's a good idea, and so he signs into law that very decree. Mordecai convinces Esther to break the law and to go into the king to explain the matters and to ask for his leniency or to some way to remedy the situation. That ends us in chapter 4 with the agreement that Esther has that she is going to go in before the king, even if it means her life. She's going to go in before the king to see if she can solve this matter. And so what I want us to notice, first of all, is the grace of Esther. The grace of Esther in all of these dealings. First of all, notice in verse 1. Well, before we do that, I want to say that there are really two kinds of grace. First, there is biblical grace. That's the grace that we talk about when we talk about unmerited favor. It's God's favor upon His people, even though we are undeserving of it. God gives us a certain measure of grace. And certainly we see that being evidenced here in Esther's life. But there's also the secular grace, what I'm calling the secular grace. And that is, I'm sure that you are familiar with people who just carry themselves graciously. We talk about sometimes Queen Elizabeth as being someone who carries herself graciously. And the idea behind that is someone who is able to conduct herself politely, someone who is able to conduct himself in such a way that he doesn't offend people just because of the way in which he does things. And we'll see in just a moment how Esther both has biblical grace and secular grace. And so verse 1 it says, "Now it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace across from the king's house while the king sat on his royal throne in the royal house facing the entrance to the house." So it says on the third day. This, of course, is after much prayer. If you recall from chapter 4, verse 16, it says that she was going to go in before the king, but she was going to wait 3 days. And she was calling upon all of Israel to pray for 3 days and to fast and to humble themselves and prepare themselves for this time. And it says she and all of her servants will do likewise. And so for 3 days, she has been praying and fasting, preparing her heart for this situation. She has humbled herself before the Lord. And so she puts on her royal robes. Now, we're not sure exactly why she put on her royal robes. If you were to recall back earlier in the chapter, Mordecai actually instructs her to go before the king humbly in sackcloth and in ashes to try to persuade him of the seriousness of the matter of the extermination of the Jews. But we find here that she does not do that. She actually puts on her royal robe. And I'm not sure exactly the details as to why that is. It could be that she did not want to yet reveal the real situation. We see the fact that she waits for two good meals before she actually reveals what the truth is. And so it could be that she didn't want to do that. It could also be that she was trying to present herself as the queen, petitioning the king of a certain request. But we do know this, that she came before the king in her royal robe. And it says that she went into the chamber of the king. This is the inner chamber. And if you recall, this was a huge chamber. There was probably a great deal of people there. We know that from Josephus, who was an extra-biblical writer, a historian of the time, that this chamber was actually filled with soldiers or guardsmen who carried axes waiting to cut off the heads of anyone who would come before the king unannounced. Well, here we have Esther coming in unannounced before the king. And apparently the way that this room was set up was there was this entrance, and it was within line of sight of the king so that the king could see who it was that was coming into the room. And as the king looks, he sees Queen Esther coming into the room. And it says in verse 2, "So it was when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, that she found favor in his sight. Now, she found favor probably because the grace of God was upon her. The word grace means favor. We know the words are interchangeable often in the scriptures, and Joseph found favor with the Lord. Moses found favor. Abraham found favor. All these people were favored by God. They were given a certain measure of grace. And indeed, Esther was given a certain measure of grace. But I can't help but also think that Ahasuerus found favor with Esther in part because of her attitude and because of her actions. And so in verse 2, it came into the court, and she found favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. And Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter. If you remember, this was the means of communicating that the king allowed her into his presence. It was against the law to go in before the king unannounced. And yet the only exception to the rule is if he let out his scepter to the one that was coming in as a sign of favor. And sure enough, what we find here is we find him laying out his scepter. And she comes up and she puts her hand upon the scepter, indicating that she understands that he has found favor with her. And so we see them going through this protocol necessary in order to show honor and appropriate respect to the king. And so in verse 3, and the king said to her, "What do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you, up to half my kingdom." Now, obviously, he's speaking hyperbolic here. He's not really saying she can have half of his kingdom. He wouldn't have given away half of his kingdom even to his queen. But what is he saying? He's saying, "Look, I found favor in your eyes. What do you want, queen? I'll give it to you." Now, this must have been already a step of encouragement for Esther. If you recall, she was going before the king without knowing what his response would be. It could have been her death. And certainly, she was preparing for that. And yet, she found favor in his eyes. So verse 3, he's willing to give up whatever it is that she wants of him. Verse 4, so Esther answered, "If it pleases the king." Notice how she speaks there. She's speaking humbly. She's speaking respectfully. She's appropriately addressing him with honor and with dignity. So Esther answered, "If it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him." She anticipated his response, or at least she expected his response. She had already prepared a banquet for him, and when she goes before him, it's ready to go. And so she says, I can't read into the scriptures, but I think there was a conversation, something like this: "Come to the banquet I prepared." He's like, "When?" And she's like, "It's ready. Dinner's prepared. Get Haman." So later, of course, we see him urging Haman, "Come on, quickly, let's go. Dinner's ready. She's prepared a banquet for us." She was wise, wasn't she? What's the old saying? That a way to a man's heart is through his stomach, right? She's preparing his heart. As her heart was prepared by the Lord, now she is going. She's preparing him to show favor to her. And she, of course, is doing that the right way. She's buttering him up, so to speak, right? You've been in a situation before, no doubt, where you've got an issue that you have to talk to someone about, and it's a difficult issue. You don't just come right out and say it, do you? You first kind of like spread the plate, right? You get it ready. And that's what she's doing here. And she's getting the banquet together. I mean, who wouldn't want to go to a banquet, especially if someone else prepared it? If you remember in chapter 1, he prepares this huge banquet. And he has all of his dignitaries come together. And he's doing this for, it says, 7 months. He's holding this huge banquet for all in his house and all of his dignitaries. And this is the second time we see a banquet being held. But this time, it's being held for him. Wasn't that special? And of course, it is preparing him to respond to her. So verse 6. And at the banquet of wine, the king said to Esther, "What is your petition? And it shall be granted you. What is your request? Up to half my kingdom, it shall be done." Now this is the second of three times he is having to actually ask her what it is that's really on her heart. You see, he knows it's not just a banquet. He knows that there's something more to it that she has of request. I mean, after all, think about it. She wouldn't go before the king on the threat of death just to invite him to a banquet. There has to be something more to it. And she knows that. He knows that. And so he's asking her, okay, what is it? Now that we've had this banquet, now that I've, you know, you've got my attention. And it says that they're relaxing over the wine. He says, okay, now what is it, Esther? Really, what can I do for you? And she says, yeah, I can't help but think there was a pause there. Because what she says next is kind of anticlimactic. Look at what she says. She says in verse 7, then Esther answered and said, my petition request is this. If I have found favor in your sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman come to a banquet tomorrow, which I prepared for them. And tomorrow, I'll do as the king requested. Now, I don't know at this stage whether she was already intentionally planning on delaying it one more day, or whether it was just a situation where she just was not yet ready to say what it was. I mean, I'm sure you've been there before. You've had to broach a subject with somebody, and you start into the conversation, and you're making some small talk, maybe just trying to do some stuff to kind of let off a little bit of the steam and just kind of get things going, you know, and then you're thinking to yourself, okay, when am I going to really say it? When am I going to really say it? And the conversation goes on, and you're just delaying, you're talking about everything else, and then, all right, well, we'll see you later. And you go home, you tell your wife, your husband, and they say, well, did you talk to him about it? Tomorrow I'm going to do it. I can't help but think that's what Esther's doing here. This is not an easy request. She is asking him basically to reverse an irreversible law. She's going before him and asking him to eat crow before all of his dignitaries. I mean, this is a serious thing. And I can't help but think that she's thinking to herself, just come to a banquet tomorrow too. And so we are ending verse 8 with that. And I have to ask ourselves this question. What is it then that we would say would characterize Esther's attitude and Esther's actions that would identify her as full of grace? Well, I think one thing it was is that she was humble. The way in which she approached the king. She entered humbly. She stood at a distance. She didn't presume upon her ability as a queen to go before the king. She also spoke to the king humbly. She says, if it pleases the king, if I have found favor with the king. In fact, it reminds me of Proverbs chapter 22, verse 11. It says, he who loves purity of heart and has grace on his lips, the king will be his friend. She was also honoring. She followed standard protocol when she went and she touched the scepter, indicating that she was willing to submit to the laws of the land as they were, and that she was not just coming in brazenly before the king. She was honoring the rules and the laws and the regulations that were there. Her speech was honoring to the king, as we've looked at. And she, she seemed to be following the general principles in Scripture that we are to honor those who were in authority over us. I think of Romans chapter 13, verse 7. It says, render therefore to all their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, custom to whom customs, fear to whom fear, and honor to whom honor. And even though Ahasuerus was the one who had signed into law a petition to destroy off all of her family and herself even, she didn't go in before the king saying, look, king, you can't. She went in honorably, submissively, with respect. Leviticus chapter 19, verse 32 tells us this. You shall rise before the gray-headed and honor the presence of old man and fear your God, I am the Lord. You know, there's something, this is an aside note, a little tangent maybe, if you will. There's something that is disturbing to me in our culture. And that is the lack of disrespect for those who deserve honor. And I think particularly when it comes to the elderly. And you know, the scriptures here, as I just read in Leviticus chapter 19 to 32, it says that we are to stand before the gray-headed. You know, I remember back in the day, in fact, my parents told me that when a lady comes into the room, you stand. How often is that done today? Never. When the most senior of the people comes into the room, do people stand today? They don't stand today. They just go about their business, right? That's showing disrespect. But that's not what Esther did, is it? Esther was showing proper protocol. She was proper etiquette, proper morals, proper behavior. You know, sometimes children don't like to be taught manners, you know? But the reality is that manners is a way of showing respect to somebody else, isn't it? I mean, why don't you chew with your mouth open? Because it's disrespectful to people eating with you. I mean, it's just... Well, Esther understood the grace of living in a society where she can, you know, she can get ahead by honoring, and so she does that. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 17 says, honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. And we also know that she was wise in the way in which she showed her grace. She builds the tension to where king has to resolve the issue. You know, I remember when we're teaching my kids how to write, as you might imagine, being homeschooling, and we took this writing course this last year, and one of the keys or the secrets to good writing, they said, was building tension. And if you read any good book or you watch a good movie or something like that, it always basically is the same, and that is they build tension, build tension, build tension, build tension, until finally you're like, come on, give me the solution, right? And then finally there's a climax and a solution and a resolution. And you're like, good. Well, that's what she's doing here, isn't it? She's wise. She's building the tension. Come to the banquet. And I'll tell you. Come to the banquet. He says, what is it, Esther? And she goes, come tomorrow to another banquet. And then I'll tell you. You see, what's she doing? She's pulling him along to where finally at the end, he's going to say, all right, look, Esther, it doesn't matter what it is. Just tell me. She's smart in how she's going about doing this. She does what she knows will please him. You know, I can't help but think that she went and talked to the eunuch that helped her out in the beginning, remember? That helped her get actually her Haggaz, I believe it was, the eunuch. And she probably went and said, look, what's his best food? What's he like to eat most? Think I should wear my royal robe? Or you think I ought to wear this classy robe? She probably went and got advice to try to do what was pleasing to him to find his favor. And of course, she brings Haman along for the ride. We'll see why that is the case a little bit later. And so what can we learn from this? Well, we must be prepared. We must prepare our hearts before God before we do anything of significance. We must prepare our hearts before God before we do anything of significance. If we have our hearts prepared before God in prayer, we shall find favor with men in the time of need. For God can turn the hearts of men which way he pleases. This is usually the case, although we know that there are circumstances where people have prepared their hearts in faith, and they have their hearts right before God in prayer, and yet the Lord allows them to be persecuted. And so generally, though, we know that when our hearts are prepared before God, the outcome will be one that glorifies God. We must prepare our hearts in prayer before we approach any difficult situation. I think sometimes I know that I'm guilty of this, we brazenly just march forward without first preparing our hearts. And she was wise in spending 3 days in prayer and fasting before she goes before the king. I think a second thing that we can learn from this, or that we can take away from this, is that generally speaking, you get further in life with honey than with vinegar. You've probably heard that saying before. I don't like the smell of vinegar. I don't really much like anything about vinegar. But I love honey. And yet it seems like so often, when we approach certain circumstances and situations, we approach it with a sour attitude rather than with a sweet attitude. You probably know how the proverb plays itself out at the meal table. Let's say Jill and Jane, they go out to eat, right? And the meal comes and it's not quite what they expected. And so Jill immediately gets upset and says, well, let's call the manager over and get our money back. This is just not right. And of course, Jane will look at her and say, maybe we ought to approach it a little bit softer and more gently and request rather than demand. And that's wise. It's using honey rather than vinegar. Esther did not go in and make requests of the king, demanding an overbearing way, but she did it submissively, subtly, and sweetly, just like honey. Too often we approach our difficult situations with acidic personalities, and at the end we end up only showing that we are sour of attitude. If you're facing a challenge in the workplace or in the home, try approaching it sweetly rather than sourly. You just might find you get further with it. So how are your people skills? Would you describe yourself as full of grace and a person of grace? Now, I used to pray on a regular basis over my children, Luke chapter 2, verse 52. And in preparation of this message, my mind was triggered to that verse again, and I started praying again this week over my children. Now, it's a good thing for us to pray for one another, this very same thing, although we might want to leave out the stature part. But in Luke chapter 2, verse 52, it says, and Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. Isn't that a great prayer? That's what we should pray over our children, over our grandchildren, and over one another. May we be those who grow in wisdom and in favor with God and with man. You know, it was said that the original Cinderella had a moral. Of course, nowadays there are all kinds of Cinderella movies out there. And of course, most of the morals of the Cinderella movie now is that if you're really pretty, you can get the prince, right? That's kind of what the story goes. But the original Cinderella actually was written with a deeper moral than that. It goes like this. Beauty in a woman is a rare treasure that will always be admired. Graciousness, however, is priceless and is even of greater value. This is what Cinderella's godmother gave to her when she taught her to behave like a queen. Young woman, in the winning of a heart, graciousness is more important than the beauty of a hairdo. Without it, nothing is possible. With it, one can do anything. That's what Esther exhibited. She exhibited that graciousness of character. Now, we contrast that with Haman. Haman had a grasping character, always trying to grasp for something more. And so we compare him in verse 9. We start reading about him. It says, so Haman went out that day joyful and with a glad heart. Now, if we could stop there, we'd say, okay, great. But it doesn't stop there, does it? But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand or tremble before him, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. He wasn't just mildly frustrated. The scriptures say that he was filled with indignation. You know what happens when you're filled up with an emotion? There's room for no other emotion, is there? And here we see Haman being filled up with indignation, filled up with wrath, to the point nothing else could be allowed in. Nothing else could get out. And so we see his anger in verse 10. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went to home, and he sent and called for his friends and his wife, Zeresh. I think it's interesting to note that he was able to restrain himself to a point. Externally, he was able to restrain himself. But deep down in his heart, we know what his heart was like. What? His heart was a murderer. We see later on him building these gallows so that he might be able to kill Mordecai upon it. And it reminds me of Matthew chapter 5, verse 21 through 22. Jesus says, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of judgment. And whoever says to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, you fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. What's Jesus saying there? He's saying murder is really sown in the heart. You know, there's all kinds of talk these days about the kind of double criminal action. If someone has the intention of killing somebody versus just killing somebody, and they have the discrimination and all this kind of stuff, hate speech and, you know, hate crimes and all this kind of stuff. The reality of it is, any murderer is a murderer of hate. That's where it starts, anger in the heart. And so verse 11 says, then Haman told them of his great riches. So he calls together all of his friends and his wife. Now, ordinarily, when you call together your friends and your wife, it's to kind of be with them, but not with Haman. Haman is so self-absorbed. Listen to what he invites his friends and his wife together for. It says, then Haman told them of his great riches. What's he doing? He's showing off. He's bragging. The multitude of his children. Now, this strikes me as funny. I mean, he invites his wife, right? He invites all of his friends. Don't they know how many children he has? And can you imagine him saying, don't you realize, wife, how many children we have? She's thinking, yeah. I was the one who gave birth to all of them, right? But what's he doing? He's bragging. He's being arrogant. And so not only is he angry, but he's arrogant, and it's showing forth here in verse 11. It says, the multitude of his children, everything in which the king had promoted him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. Moreover, Haman said, besides, Queen Esther invited no one but me to come in with the king to the banquet, and she is prepared. And tomorrow I will go again and invite her along and be invited with her with the king. He's saying, look, this is a great life I've got. I've got all these kids. I've got all this wealth. I've got all this power, all this prestige. Isn't this wonderful? He's bragging about it. It says, verse 13, yet all this avails me nothing so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting in the king's gate. See, people who have an angry heart, people who are selfish, they never get enough grasping, do they? It's always something more. Never content, never satisfied. It's always wanting more. So he's a braggart. Proverbs chapter 27 verse 2 says, let another man praise you and not yourself. A stranger and not your own lips. 2 Corinthians chapter 10 verse 18 says, for not he who commends himself is approved, but whom the Lord commends. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before the fall. So he's arrogant, he's pride, he's overly ambitious. He's unwilling to be content with what he has. 1 Timothy chapter 6 verse 6 says, now godliness with contentment is great gain. Haman had neither godliness nor contentment, and so he was grasping for more. So what happens in verse 14? Then his wife Zeresh, I can't help but think of Ahab and Jezebel when I think of Haman and Zeresh. Because Zeresh seems to continue to instruct him, much like Jezebel instructed Ahab. Then his wife Zeresh and all of his friends said to him, let gallows be made 50 cubits high, and in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet. And this thing pleased Haman, and so he had the gallows made. You see, it wasn't enough for him to wait until the day when all the Jews were to be executed to see Mordecai die. He had to have it now. He wanted to kill off Mordecai immediately. And so he takes the advice of his wife and his friends. He builds this gallows. Now, what a gallows was, and it says that it was 50 cubits high. Now, most likely, probably, this was a platform that was built high enough to where everybody could see it. And then the gallows were put on top of that. And the reason I say this is that the gallows was basically a big stick. It was a big spear. And the way that the gallows would work is that those who were to be put on the gallows would be stabbed with this big stick. And then they would be lifted up, so that everybody could see them impaled on this stick. And that was their form of death. And so this is what he's suggesting happens to Mordecai. He says, look, take this spear, this stake of some type, and thrusting through with it and then hoist it up so that everybody can see it. And it says that the gallows is 50 cubits. That's 75 feet. So it's probably unlikely that the whole stick is 75 feet. It's probably more likely that this was to be built up onto a pyramid, and then the very top was to be the stick sticking up out of it, and Mordecai was to be.
Are turning astray of the path that was left long ago. All we leave behind, time after time, is a legacy with nothing to show. Now our country is lost, and it's not without cost, for there's many who struggle every day. And I think that it's time we start crying for our nation and bow our heads and pray. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? Just like the plant that withers away, we will leave many seeds behind. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? What will you do to change your legacy?